Over the past year, thousands of veterans have come through the doors of the Veterans Freedom Center in Dubuque. This hour, what makes this nonprofit so effective? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, I talk with the director of Dubuque's Veterans Freedom Center. We'll also hear from the co-founder of a similar center that's just opened in Iowa City. We'll find out how these centers serve veterans differently than traditional services. Then later in the hour, I'll talk with this year's World Food Prize laureate, Sir Fasle Hassan Abed. Abed is founder of the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee. It's hailed as the most effective anti-poverty organization in the world. That's all coming up. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, my conversation with this year's World Food Prize laureate, Sir Fasle Hassan Abed. Abed is founder of the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee. It's hailed as the most effective anti-poverty organization in the world. But first, within the past year, thousands of Iowans have sought help at the Veterans Freedom Center in Dubuque. It's a nonprofit organization devoted to veterans who may have fallen through the cracks of more traditional outreach programs for veterans. My guest this half hour, Al Rowell. He's assistant director and co-founder of that center in Dubuque, joins us by phone. Hello, Al.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Also joining us in our Iowa City studio this half hour, Larry Dingman, director and fundraiser for the Veterans Liberty Center in Iowa City, a center similar to the one in Dubuque. In fact, inspired by it, I believe. Larry Dingman, welcome to you.
Thank you for having us. Hi, Al.
How you doing, Larry?
Good, good.
Since you're first there in Dubuque with this new type of center, Al, tell us about it. What do we see coming through the door? What happens within those doors?
Well, we have very broad spectrum of veterans. We have our oldest usually stops down is 95, and the youngest is about 21. We have a very broad variety of problems and different people that come down through. We also have the We Care Center here that we provide wheelchairs, walkers, and everything else for anyone in a veteran's family or a veteran that needs help that way. We have anything that we can help them with in mobility. We also have the Give a Lift to a Vet where we support the van that runs back and forth to Iowa City, taking our veterans there.
Mm-hmm. To the VA Medical Center in Iowa City.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. It's also a place, and this is an important thing, just to hang out.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. What happens? What's going on there? TV, conversation, games?
We have games. We have different things set up different days of the week. Monday and Friday is just a casual day. Tuesdays, we have a pool tournament that the guys can come down and get into. Wednesdays, we have a euchre tournament that the guys can get into. And Thursday, we have darts, like in the bars. They throw darts at the board. Mm-hmm. So we try to keep guys busy. We also have the complete wood shop out here and an arts and crafts center that keeps the guys' hands and so on busy. And sometimes that's a very large thing because it takes your mind off some of the other stuff.
How is your center different than other centers available, other gathering places for vets and places like the VA, for instance, where veterans can get services?
Here, we get no outside help from any government agency or anywhere else. We're totally funded by the community through fundraisers and so on. So we're blessed to live in a great community, in a great state that thinks a lot about the vets, and they go behind us 100%.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting story how your center got started. What did you tell us that, Al?
Yeah, that was the other founder, Jim Wagner, had a garage, and he was trying to rebuild a 1985 Monte Carlo. And all of a sudden, we had more and more vets stopping in and being part of the place. Well, pretty soon, we were buying coffee makers and pizza machines, and he kind of couldn't get a whole lot done. And we knew there was a need, and we kept putting our heads together, and we kept getting told there's no way we could do that. Well, when you tell two Army old veterans that you can't do something, well, it's going to get done one way or the other. And we started with a building that we worked 7 days a week on it, probably 16 hours a day for a month and a half or so, and we got it up and running. And it was hard to get the word out, the name out, and we're always reaching out to veterans to try to help. We even help some financially to come back that get in trouble. Mm-hmm. If the Dubuque County Commission of Veterans Affairs can't assist them in any way, that's where we pick up. Mm-hmm. And we work very closely with them and other agencies.
It certainly seems like you've gotten the word out. Over 6,000 vets coming through your door there in Dubuque last year?
Last year we had 6,700 veterans signed through the door in a year's time from January 1 to January 1.
Are those all Iowans, or do they come from out of state?
We don't ask where they're from. As long as they're a veteran, come on in and enjoy the place, and we can help you do whatever you want. And everything we do here, from making pins to woodworking to the arts and crafts and everything else, is all done at totally no cost to the veteran whatsoever. And one other big thing about the Veterans Center here is all the donations that we take in are used at 100% rate. There isn't a person here that gets paid. And this is why it works so well. Our volunteers are all majority veterans, and they've been through a lot of this. So when a guy's having trouble or a lady's having trouble, you know, you can relate to it very easily, and that helps in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Al Rowell is with us, Assistant Director and co-founder of the Veterans Freedom Center in Dubuque. A similar center has just opened in Iowa City. Larry Dingman, you are director and fundraiser at the Veterans Liberty Center in Iowa City. Did you take your cue from the Dubuque Center? Was that the model, the inspiration?
Absolutely. It was suggested to me that we needed one of these in Iowa City, and so I went up and visited with Jim and Al and numerous other people up there, and we came back and we thought about it, and basically since the 1st of March we've been looking for a building, and about a month ago, and we found one, and an anonymous donor gave us a building for a year at no cost. So we're just getting open, and the rest of the interview, actually, Al's already done, but we're not anywhere near where Al and Jim and those people are yet, although we're going to get there at some point in time. It just takes time to get it done.
You are open. You've been open how many days or since when?
We're open the 1st of October, and we're still furnishing the facility right now. We've got some furniture in it. We're picking up a new pool table tomorrow, actually an old new pool table, one of the old slate ones. And we have some chairs. We need some some lounge chairs yet, and some end tables and numerous other things, but we're getting there, and it's located at 2116-18 South Riverside Drive. So,
Are you, even though it's very early days and you're still outfitting the donated building for you, are you getting some veterans discovering you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We've had, since the opening, we've had probably 35 or 40 veterans come through, and actually two of them needed jobs, so we got them job interviews, and I don't know how that's turned out, but we got job interviews for them from local merchants. So, and that's the whole idea behind our basically what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, Larry Dingman, two veterans are joining me this half hour to talk about these unique new centers. First one starting in Dubuque, and that's the Veterans Freedom Center in Dubuque, and then just opening, as you just heard, the Veterans Liberty Center in Iowa City. Al Rowell and Larry Dingman on this edition of River to River. Let me ask you, Larry Dingman, the same question I asked Al Rowell. What makes this center work differently? It seems like a no-brainer that all this need is there, and all of a sudden you open a center, very simple, doesn't rely on any government, donations and fundraising, and that's it, and the flocks come.
Well, there's, as Al said, there's a certain number of people that slip through the cracks in any system. I don't care what it is. But in the VA, that goes on also. And what our goal is to create an atmosphere that's tobacco and alcohol free, for one thing, and for veterans with their families to come and socialize with other veterans and their families. And if they have special needs and they talk to us about it and we can fill those needs, then that's what we intend to do. We intend to, in the future, partner with several other veterans organizations in order to fill those kind of needs. Mm-hmm. For an example, we have already partnered with the English River Outfitters, which is based south of Washington, Iowa. A gentleman by the name of Chuck Geertz started this about 6 years ago, and he takes veterans who've lost their limbs and that want to go hunting and they want to go fishing and they want to do all sorts of other things. He's got wheelchairs that are on tracks, and he can take them into timber, and he takes them all over the United States, boar hunts, deer hunts, all kinds of hunts, and it gives them their life back. You know, a lot of them sit around on a daily basis with nothing to do. There's veterans from all over the mid-United States come to the Iowa City VA because of the value and the way that they're treated here. This is one of the best veterans administrative organizations in the country, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. So,
Al Rowell, let me ask you this. How is this center different than an American Legion or a VFW?
Well, everything we do here and at Larry's, we form around the veterans. PTSD and so on, and TBI is a horrifying thing for family and everyone else. And if we can make their life better and show them that they can still be valuable to the community and do stuff, this is a big thing. It takes fundraising from probably the middle of April until Veterans Day. Then we take a little break in the winter, but other than that, it takes a lot to keep it going, but it's so worthwhile. And you can help a veteran, and when he walks out of here with a smile on his face, that means his home life is better. Mm-hmm. If his home life is better, he's doing great.
You mentioned TBI, traumatic brain injury, and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Let's take PTSD. Al, what makes your center effective in dealing with our veterans who suffer from PTSD?
Well, the first thing, myself and Jim Wagner both have it, and we have a lot of our volunteers that do have it. This is our therapy to help out here. This is how we get by. Out in public, I don't do real good, but Jim does very well, and that's why we form everything around the veteran. If we have something here, they don't have something here that they would be interested in. If we can find the need for it and the useful part of it, we will go out and get it, or we'll find a way to get it.
Mm-hmm. And a veteran with PTSD is more likely, if he knows other veterans with many with a similar condition, he's more likely to voice it?
Yes, they are. And when they come down here, this is a safe place for them. Mm-hmm. This is a place where they can come down and talk about just about anything. We get to know a few of the veterans, and as they walk through the door, you see this long face in the morning. Uh-oh. What's happening? You know, what's the problem? A lot of times, anybody just needs to vent a little bit and get it out and find out that somebody else has these same problems. And this is a big thing.
Right.
They have to feel useful again. When you get this and you start isolating, that's a bad thing because then things just manifest. When you can come down and stay busy doing things, making pens, working on the scroll saws, or just going out there and having a game of pool or something with somebody, and there's always coffee on, this gives them a reason to be here, and it gets them out. Isolating is a terrible thing.
Right, and we're so saddened by the our veterans. The suicide rate among our veterans is just so high. When someone comes through the door is a serious case, you can connect them with, I assume, resources that you don't have there.
Exactly. If we have anyone that's having a very, very bad time, and that's a judgment call, we literally call up to the CBOC here in Dubuque, the clinic, and we'll call up there, and we'll literally get them in the car, and I'll take them up myself and sit there and go route through it with them. And sometimes they just, if they're bad enough, then they'll take them right straight to Iowa City or whatever. But they get them the help that they need. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing is it's not uncommon for veterans to have some of these problems. And when they find out they're not the only one there and that the help is available, the VA gets them through the PTSD courses that they have. They get them on the right medication and stuff. It doesn't stop it by any means. It never goes away, but you learn how to handle it. Learn what the triggers are and stuff like this.
I wonder if you would, Al, mind sharing a little bit of the experiences that led to your PTSD.
I was a person that isolated terribly. I found a job and I worked. It was a good job, but I worked third shift, and that's where I stayed.
Where were you stationed in the military?
I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then after that Vietnam experience, you just kept it inside?
Well, you didn't have a whole lot of choice because when we came home, the help wasn't there. The VA system was a totally different place then. Now it's a great place. And like Larry said, our VA here in Iowa City is one of the best in the country as far as I'm concerned. The people care, and that's a big thing. Mm-hmm. When you isolate, things just keep manifesting. And it's hard on family. It's hard on everything. The divorce rate, suicide rate, it's all there. If you can reach out and touch these people, then this starts coming down. The suicide rate, I would give my right arm to help one person a day keep from doing that. That's our whole goal in life, is just anybody we can save. We actually have people here at this center. We have four or five of them that will come right out and tell you, if it wouldn't be for this center, they wouldn't be here, because they were at their lowest point when they found this place.
Amazing. Larry Dingman, you've only been open days in your Iowa City Veterans Liberty Center, but you said you've connected with 40 or 50 veterans already. Some of those serious cases, you can see the need there. Obviously, the Dubuque Center has made such a difference in that community so far.
Yes, and I understand. Al knows a lot more about this than I do. Obviously, I'm kind of an apprentice at it, we're just in the embryo stage of our organization, but we'll get there at some point in time. But, yes, we haven't had any PTSB, to my knowledge, come through yet, but we have had the person that takes care of that at the hospital come and introduce himself, and he will actually be at our board meeting this coming Wednesday night. So he gave us a short course on what to look for in PTSB people and the questions to ask. And so these are the kind of things that we need to learn, or I need to learn anyway. And I'm sure that my partner, Jerry Peters, does also. So anyway, Al probably explains it the best. He didn't really need me for this interview. Al's taking care of it. So he's been at it a lot longer.
Al, tell me, to your knowledge, how unique is this sort of center for veterans in the state, in the country?
We're pretty proud of it, because when we first started this, and we were about a year into it, we were told it was one of the only ones in the country that runs like this, that has no outside forms of income other than donations. And that's one thing that we are very proud of. 100% of what comes in here stays here. There isn't a person at this center that gets paid.
And in the center, like the one here in Iowa City, the grounds, the upkeep, everything donated?
Well, actually, we're in a building that doesn't have any grounds upkeep, but we rent from Rainbow Oil, and they're a great outfit, and they take care of the building and everything else. If something goes wrong, they keep it up. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we keep the inside up ourselves.
And I imagine among those veterans, you've got a lot of handy men and women there that can pitch in whenever it's needed.
Oh, yeah, and that's why we try to get them to use them skills and making stuff and to find out they are still useful. They can do some amazing things. Actually, Dubuque County Commission of Veterans Affairs, our clinic up here and stuff, they see somebody that's having trouble, they recommend them to us and tell them to stop down, and then they'll give us a heads up that somebody's coming.
Right.
And we just take them. The veterans down here get treated just like all the rest of us. We each have problems. Some are a little more sensitive than others, but that's what they love down here.
They're one
of the group.
Somebody may be interested in helping out. Are all of your volunteers veterans or non-veterans?
No, they're not all veterans. We have a few ladies and some other people that come down that are not veterans, but they're here because they care, and they fit in quite well. They go through we try anybody out for a while. In fact, we even have a person on our board that is not a veteran that helps us with outside stuff, and that's a good thing.
We've got just a couple minutes. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
You got to have that outside influence. Sometimes we're doing something a little bit different, and they'll have a better idea.
Yep. We've got a couple minutes left, Al and Larry, but I'm sure there are people listening across Iowa, also in other states, who are saying, my community might do well with one of these types of centers here. Al, now that you've spawned another center, and hopefully these will spread for the good of all veterans across the state and the country, what advice would you give to someone listening who thinks one of these centers would be good for their community?
Don't take no for an answer. it sounds simple, but it's not. You're going to beat your head against the wall, use money out of your own pocket and everything else, and we still do that from time to time. But it's for such a cause. When you love something, it's very easy to do. Just don't give up. It helps that we have a man on our board that owns a radio station, and he helps us with advertising and all that kind of stuff. And now we've got the whole community on board for doing stuff like that. You just have to reach out and find that way. You're going to hear, no, it ain't going to work. Well,
what are the biggest challenges your center has faced in growing and establishing itself?
Our biggest thing was getting the word out to the veterans to find out where we were. Everything else, we can beat the door down and take care of the rest of it. It's getting the veteran in here. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's great now that we start working with the county and the clinic up here, that they start recommending people to us. And it took a long time, but we're well looked up at now in the community, and that helps. It helps.
Right, right. And veterans as a bunch are a little skeptical and leery about new things?
A veteran is a very proud person, and sometimes they get them to admit that, maybe we do have a problem. Yeah, it is. But once they do, it's looking brighter. And if you can make a man or a woman's life at home better, you're making their total situation. Mm-hmm. That's what you need.
Al, quickly, before we have to go, what do you see in the future? What are your goals now?
We want to still keep reaching out and getting more young people in here. That is our main goal. Keep it going.
Is it the younger veterans that are the problems coming in? I mean, problem to get them to come in rather than the older folks?
Well, some of them have got jobs and everything else, so it's
sure.
Hard to get them. But they have the same problems we do. And as we're getting them in, we're finding that out. The word's getting out. And that's word of mouth is the best thing you can do.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, Al Rowell, Assistant Director and co-founder of the Veterans Freedom Center in Dubuque. Thank you for your service to our country and your service establishing what sounds like a wonderful center there in Dubuque.
Well, thank you very much.
Larry Digman, thank you for your work, your service to our country, and good luck with the opening of the Veterans Liberty Center in Iowa City, and thanks for coming into our studio today.
Thank you for having me again. I appreciate it.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll have the 2015 World Food Prize Laureate. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The World Food Prize is an annual international award that recognizes the achievements of individuals who've advanced human development by improving the quality, quantity, or availability of food in the world. My guest this half hour is Sir Fazlay Hassan Abed. He is the 2015 World Food Prize Laureate, and the honor was given to him for his work as founder and chairperson of the world's largest anti-poverty organization, the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee. It goes by the acronym BRAC. Many have hailed it as the most effective anti-poverty organization in the world. Under Abed's leadership of more than 40 years, its agricultural and development innovations have improved security for millions. Also, it's contributed to a significant decline in poverty levels through direct impacts to farmers and small communities across the globe. The organization has provided opportunity for nearly 150 million people worldwide. Sir Fazlay Hassan Abed, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, and thank you for a wonderful introduction.
I understand that the birth of your organization stems from a couple of cataclysmic events in Bangladesh, homeland, the deadly tropical cyclone, and then the War of Independence from Pakistan. Tell us how your organization was born in the midst of that.
Well, I worked for Shell Oil Company as one of their senior executives in 1970, when a cyclone occurred in the November of that year, which killed 300,000 people. And when I went to do some relief work in some of the offshore islands, which was devastated by the cyclone, I started questioning the kind of life I was leading as a comfortable business executive in the face of the fragility of life of human beings, sort of taken away by a cyclone of that magnitude. And so the transformation started happening at that time. And then, of course, immediately after that, there was the struggle for independence from Pakistan, which lasted almost 9 months. But with the aid of our own independence fighters and the help of India, we became independent fairly soon. And so in early 1972, Bangladesh was independent. Bangladesh was born as an independent country. And of course, at that time, Bangladesh was the poorest country on earth. Its the problems were tremendous, immense, and the problems were multifaceted. It was the poorest country. It had very high population, 70 million population, and the Bangladesh is the size of Iowa. So you can see that about 50 times the population of Iowa in 1972. And now, of course, we have more than doubled our population. So now we are 50 times the population of Iowa's. So population was one of the very, very high population. Mm-hmm. We had life expectancy at birth of 46. Our child mortality rate was 250 per 1,000, which means that one in four children died before their fifth birthday. Our maternal mortality was very high. Our fertility was out of control. Average women produced 6.4 children. So these were the situation in Bangladesh.
Let me ask you, you said the average life expectancy, 46 years. What were what contributed to that low life expectancy?
Mostly it was because of high infant and child mortality. As I said, 25% of the children died before their fifth birthday. So that, of course, reduced.
Is this starvation or disease?
It's disease, mostly diarrhea and pneumonia and things like that. And we didn't immunize all our children, as a result of which unimmunized children, of course, had a higher death rate. So that was one of them. And, of course, now Bangladesh is, now that we have been able to had some dramatic declines in infant and child mortality as well as maternal mortality, we have been able to bring about control in fertility rates. It used to be 6.4 children per woman. Now it's 2.1. So as a result, Bangladesh is now becoming almost, we have achieved replacement-level fertility.
Mm-hmm. So how did you achieve on the fertility aspect there? How did you achieve that? Because especially poor families are not willing to often give up the ability to make children because that's the way
sort of protect their future.
Exactly.
Yeah. What happened is that we thought that unless we can bring down child mortality, infant and child mortality in a dramatic way, we will not be able to get women to accept family planning. So we took up a program in 1980. It was 1979, it was the International Year of the Child. So we decided that we should do something in Bangladesh which would have an impact on infant and child mortality. So we took up a program for 10 years to go from house to house, teach mothers how to make oral rehydration fluid at home with salt, sugar, and water, which sort of rehydrated the body of children who were suffering from diarrhea. And that had a big impact in terms of diarrheal mortality reduction. And then also in 1986, BRAC, together with the government, took up the institutionalized immunization program. It took the immunization rate from 4% in 1986 to 72% in 1990. It took us 4 years to institutionalize immunization program in the country. And that immunization and oral dehydration now being practiced throughout the country meant that the infant mortality rate started declining dramatically. In fact, last year, Lancet, a medical journal in England, they came out with a report on Bangladesh's health status and said that nowhere in the world, other than possibly the time in Japan in 1868 after the Meiji Restoration, no other country has been able to reduce infant and child mortality at the rate at which Bangladesh has been able to do.
Mm-hmm. How did Bangladeshi women then, the families, become comfortable with having fewer children then?
So less mortality means that the fewer children would survive to adulthood. And as a result, women were quite content having two children rather than six in order to ensure protection in old age. And secondly, also, the other thing has happened is that the children mostly in early days were not going to school, so there was not much of an investment on children's future. And now that most children are now going, more than 95% of our children are in school, it means that children are families are having to now invest money in their education. So as a result, the number of children has reduced, and the families are now not only producing less children, but also investing more in their children's future. As a result, fertility has declined. There is a theory propounded by one of the economists in Australia who said that if the intergenerational resource flow, if the resource flows from younger to the older generation, the fertility tends to be high. And if the resource flows from older to the younger generation, fertility tends to be low. So if you have two children, if you have to invest money on their education, and you don't expect anything to come to you afterwards, then of course you will keep your fertility low. In other words, you'll have less children.
Mm-hmm.
So that's theory seemed to have worked very well in Bangladesh, in the sense that as soon as women started investing in the education of their children, the fertility declined. And now we have got 2.1 fertility rate, which is the replacement level fertility.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Sir Fasle Hassan Abed. He is the 2015 World Food Prize laureate, and we're talking about his work as the founder and chairperson of the world's largest anti-poverty organization. Many hail it as the most effective anti-poverty organization in the world, the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, also known as BRAC. We mentioned women there. You focus as an organization in rural areas. You concentrate on specific disadvantaged populations,
right.
Landless women, fishermen.
Right. Right.
Talk about women. Why is a focus on women, empowering women as agents of change?
Yes, that's what we have done. From our own experience working in villages, we saw that women actually bore the brunt of poverty. In other words, if there was lacking in food in the family, the woman who was going to go and beg, borrow, or steal from neighbors to feed their children. So the the burden of poverty fell disproportionately on women. So we thought that if women could manage poverty, then why shouldn't they be able to also manage development? And that's one of the reasons why we started, when we started microfinance, financial services for the poor, we concentrated on women as agents of change. And so the money in the hands of women also meant that they used it more effectively. They used it also in the, for the purpose to help their families, educate children, bring food to the table, and so on, which not necessarily giving men financial services would have the same kind of result.
Mm-hmm. And did the men accept this, or was that part of the education?
Initially, they resented that, but then gradually, when they realized that the after all, giving women the chance to have access to resources meant that they were also helping the family itself. So the family benefited from women's agency more than if all the money went to men.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think men realized and then supported the program.
When you looked at the causes, the factors that fed into poverty through generations, which factors are at the top of the list?
I think powerlessness was one.
Powerlessness.
Inability to think that they can get out of poverty by their own agency, because these things were stacked against them too much. There was collision between the moneylenders, the police, the elite. They were all against the poor, and they were paying the minimum wages to the poor, the landless people. And they without some form of empowerment and building a sense of self-worth,
mm-hmm.
it was not possible to get the poor to understand that they could actually, by their own work, own activities, own action, can change their own lives and destinies. So what we had to do initially was to empower the poor, build a sense of self-worth in them, and then only that we could get poor to act on their own behalf to change their situation and defeat poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what. So my work has been mostly on empowerment area in bringing about social change through empowerment and behavioral change among the poor themselves.
Where are efforts, the world's efforts in poor countries, poverty-stricken countries, has not been so effective? Do you think a problem has been, and it fits in with what you just said, that there has been a dependence that has been fostered rather than this...
Absolutely. I believe in that, because I think we have always looked at poor people as objects that we then need to be changed by us, and we never thought of poor people as subjects who can themselves be actors in history themselves, to act out of their own themselves to defeat poverty, to change their condition, and so I think the philosophy of development was to some extent had to change. The development practitioners felt that it is they who are changing poor people's lives. But we have always thought that it is us who are going to create the enabling conditions for the poor people to act on their own behalf and change their lives. So we ourselves as a development practitioners, we felt that it is not our job to change poor people's lives. Our people was to create enabling conditions for them to be able to act on their own behalf. So when we started microfinance, financial services, it was an approach which was a market-based approach. We gave loans to poor people without collateral, and they repaid the loan. But then it was an opportunity, an enabling condition for them to have access to resources so that they could act, they could take advantage of that, invest it, use it in a particular way so that they could come out of poverty or increase their income.
I wonder if you can give me a concrete example. We talked about men, you focusing on women in Bangladeshi families because they bore the brunt of poverty. What happens generally, and this is generally speaking in Bangladeshi society, when you give a loan to a woman versus a man? How does a man spend it differently, typically?
The man looks at the woman as a part of the family. So if woman invests her money, let's say, buying a cow, and the family gets milk every day, so the family has a better nutrition. And if they sell milk to the neighbors and earn an income, a regular income from selling of milk from the cow, then of course the family has got a regular income to be able to so that they can feed the family throughout the year. So these are helpful. So enabling condition for the poor to be able to come out of poverty. So the men didn't resent that.
Yeah, but what would the men have done? Say you had employed this and given the loans to the men. What would have happened, do you think?
I think what would have happened is that he probably would have invested in somewhere else. He would probably also have used it for himself to some extent. He would be less. He'll be spending less of his less of the resources for family's benefit. In other words, food and education for children and so on, which women do. And also, I have found, for example, many defeated men, but very few defeated women.
Mm-hmm. You have, through your organization, provided opportunity for nearly 150 million people. What's left? You've had 40 years of leadership of the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee. Where do you want to take it from here?
Well, we have now gone into 11 other countries out of Bangladesh. And many of the things that we work in, our work in Bangladesh that has proven to be successful and effective, we have also taken some of them to other countries in Africa and Asia. And many of them, with very minor adaptation, has been used very effectively in other countries in Africa and Asia. So I think we have got something that we have learned we could share with our neighbors in the south who are also suffering from similar problems of poverty and deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
So that is happening, and we are expanding to other countries. We also find that, struggles, aspirations, dreams of the poor are remarkably similar in most countries, developing countries. So our programs to try and emancipate people out of poverty has been quite successful in other parts of Africa and Asia also, where we have been active in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. It's been over 40 years since you worked for Shell Oil there in accounting as a corporate executive. I'm just remembering your first words there when you said you can't look at what's happening in your homeland to continue as a comfortable corporate executive.
Right.
How often do you get in touch with the person you used to be and think about the huge decision you made at that moment?
Well, at that moment, at that time when I took the decision, most of my friends and family thought I was crazy. But then that crazy adventure was so satisfying and productive for me. So I have never looked back and thought that I have made a mistake. It has been extremely satisfying business of working to try and help people out of poverty, in millions of people out of poverty in Bangladesh and now in Africa and Asia.
Mm-hmm. You're visiting Iowa as the 2015 World Food Prize laureate. You mentioned at the start that Iowa is roughly the size of Bangladesh. Can you see how we're different here from the people of your homeland?
Well, Iowa, of course, is the fruit of the bread basket of the United States. You produce a lot of food for this country and also for the world. When Bangladesh started, we had a deficit of about 3 million tons of food grain that we needed to be imported to feed our people. Now, 42 years later, although our population has more than doubled, per capita food availability is much higher now, and we are food self-sufficient. So we don't need to import food from outside. So Iowa certainly, and particularly agricultural science, has contributed to better practices, better quality seeds, and so on, which has been part of the legacy of Norman Borlaug, who instituted the World Food Prize. So his legacy still has an impact in many countries in Africa and Asia.
Well, once again, congratulations on this well-deserved honor, the 2015 World Food Prize laureate, Sir Fasleh Hassan Abed. Thank you for this conversation, all that you've achieved with the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, and thank you for sharing some of your thoughts with us on this edition of River to River.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kiefer. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you'd like to find out more about our program, perhaps listen to a podcast, download a podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs, go to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.